You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Open Society Institute. My name is Ann Beeson, and I'm the Executive Director of U.S. Programs here at the Open Society Institute, and I'm delighted to welcome you to what I'm sure will be a very interesting and informative discussion about Joshua Phillips' book. None of us were like this before. The event's being sponsored by our National Security and Human Rights Campaign, a campaign particularly near and dear to my heart as I was engaged in advocacy and litigation on national security and human rights issues for many years before coming here. And I'm shortly going to turn over the microphone to Nancy Chang, the campaign manager of that campaign, to introduce our other guest speakers. I wanted to just begin, though, by reflecting on the time we're in and the fact that this event happens, of course, the day after the 9th anniversary of 9/11. We all know that the attacks on September 11th changed the direction of countless individual lives, including my own, and I'm sure all of yours, and the direction of the country. It's become a pivotal day that is destined to define a generation and to influence the future of our country for years to come. My own personal story, and I know we all probably have our own stories about that day that change a bit over the years and the retelling, is that I would have been headed to work downtown just a few blocks away from the World Trade Center, but for a fluke that I was traveling to Washington, D.C. that day. My office was just a couple of blocks away, and every day I commuted right to the Trade Center on the PATH train from New Jersey and arrived every day at 8:45. So I would have been right there, and I often think, well, what would it have been like to be right there when it happened? Instead, I was actually at Newark Airport in line right behind one of the planes, the plane that was hijacked and took off from Newark Airport. And then I often reflect, too, well, you know, what a coincidence of fate that I wasn't on that plane, that I happened to be on a different plane going to Washington that day. And I remember in the first few days after the attack that my own reaction, and I'm sure this was true of many of us, moved from panic about the safety of my own friends and family and loved ones, and to deep sympathy for the victims of the attack, to grief and a renewed sense of patriotism for my country, and then to a growing concern about whether we would respond to those attacks in a manner that respected human rights and human dignity and respected our democratic values. The anniversary provides each of us with an important occasion to reflect on how the terrorist attacks changed each of us individually and collectively, how it changed us as a nation, and to ask what more must be done to come to terms with everything that's happened since then. How do we ensure that the values of resilience and fairness dominate in times of crisis in this country? How do we learn from both our strengths and our weaknesses as a nation? What responsibility does each of us have as citizens to hold our government accountable for its response to terrorism? Joshua Phillips' book helps us understand the impact of one devastating outcome of the aftermath of 9/11, and that is the use of torture by U.S. military and intelligence agencies as an interrogation tool in the fight against terrorism. Many books and much research have documented the devastating impact of torture on its victims. This book, importantly, chronicles the devastating impact on the perpetrators and exposes the many complex factors that led to its widespread use. Since 9/11, we have all seen public opinion shift about torture dramatically, and unfortunately, more and more Americans came to accept torture as a legitimate, if unpalatable, tactic. This book helps to shatter that perception, that misperception and belief, and helps to build public will to fully embrace, once again, our nation's commitment to the absolute prohibition on the use of torture. With that, I welcome all of our panelists and turn it over to Nancy to introduce them. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Anne, for your introduction and reflections on the anniversary of 9/11. And thanks to all of you for coming. I see so many experts in this audience. We're going to try to leave some time to have a discussion and tap some of your expertise as well. So this evening we're going to hear from Joshua Phillips, the author of None of Us Were Like This Before, American Soldiers and Torture. And then we're going to hear from, and going down to my left, we're going to hear first from Mike Blake, who I'm going to introduce individually, but he is an Iraqi veteran and a friend of one of the soldiers featured in Josh's book, and three experts, many of you know them already. One is a psychiatrist and retired brigadier general. That's Dr. Stephen Zanakis. We're going to hear next from Susan Burke, an attorney, and Professor Darius Rajali. So I have to say it's quite an honor to have Josh Phillips here. I had read in 2003 his excellent article, The Case Against the Generals, and was so impressed. It stuck with me. And when I finally met him last year and learned that he was exploring really an underexamined issue, American soldiers and torture, I eagerly invited him to come to OSI to discuss his book. It was not even a book at that time, but I'm so glad that he could come. Josh has spent the lion's share of his time since 2005 researching this book. He's traveled to Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Afghanistan, all across the United States. He's interviewed more than 150 people, from soldiers, their families, officers, detainees, victims of torture, their families, Iraqi exiles, interrogators, psychologists, lawyers, and many others. And his book offers a rich and finely woven tapestry that helps us understand this very difficult subject. I am pleased to report that Josh received the Alfred I. DuPont Columbia University Award and the Newspaper Guild's Haywood Brown Award of Substantial Distinction for an American Radio Works documentary that is based on the body of this research. It is called What Killed Sergeant Gray, and you're going to be hearing about Adam Gray's story very soon. So, Josh, on behalf of your readers, thank you for dedicating the past 5 years of your life to this illuminating book. And can you share with us what drove you to explore the subject of American soldiers and torture, what questions you set out to answer, and what you discovered?
Well, I want to thank you, Nancy, very much for putting together this panel, and OSI, of course, for sponsoring it. I greatly appreciate it. There are two questions at the heart of the book that I sought to answer. They serve as the vehicles for the book, and they include what led troops to torture, what were the situations, the factors, the conditions, and so forth, and then what are some of the unrecognized costs. And the main story that I decided to pursue was on a tank battalion, not a group of interrogators or military police, but a unit that was trained for conventional warfare. And I, even though most soldiers served with honor and distinction and never engaged in torture, there was, of course, widespread abuse and torture during the early years of the war on terror. Department of Defense, in 2006, the Department of Defense announced that they had done 800 investigations into detainee abuse and torture, 600 of which were criminal investigations. And the other reason why I thought Battalion 168 was an important vehicle for telling the story was because it existed on a forward operating base, forward operating base Lion. And if one looks at the publicly available documents at the ACLU, and hears testimony from soldiers as well as detainees, one discovers that many, if not most, of the detainee abuse by the military occurred on smaller military facilities, such as forward operating bases. These bases then delivered the detainees to Abu Ghraib and Kambuka and so forth, but they were the initial holding cell. So in 2003, Battalion 168 set up one of the facilities, as I mentioned, forward operating base Lion. And it's a base that existed in the Sunni Triangle near the city of Balad. Again, even though there was an intelligence attachment to Battalion 168, these guys were not at all interrogators. They were not trained to be military police. They were trained for conventional combat. They were trained to be tankers. So when the complexion of the Iraq War changed in 2003, units like Battalion 168 were tasked with doing sweeps, house raids, collecting insurgent suspects, and then housing them in makeshift jails like the one at Forward Operating Base Lyon. And that's when things got messy. And the soldiers of 168 basically admitted to describing a whole range of abuse, including, but not exclusive to, sleep deprivation, punishing exercises, stress positions, mock executions, kind of water torture that one associates with waterboarding. And there's not a one-size-fits-all explanation. The troops explained that they engaged in detainee abuse and, in some cases, torture for various reasons. The most common was disciplining detainees, which was commonly it was commonly done in Iraq and Afghanistan and was considered acceptable by many commanders. Troops also plainly explained that abuse was a product of anger and frustration with military operations. In some cases, it was a product of boredom. And finally, of course, they engaged in various kinds of abuse and torture because of they were tasked to help in some capacities with intelligence gathering through harsh interrogation. But one thing that the officers and the soldiers made very clear was none of them are aware of the Pentagon memos that sanctioned harsh interrogation. And this is, I think, an important point because in 2002, the researchers who helped me with this book, we discovered that there were 128 documented cases of detainee abuse in Afghanistan and 23 documented cases of detainee abuse in Guantanamo. All of this existed in 2002 before Rumsfeld's counter-resistance memo was signed and delivered to Guantanamo, which then led to other detainee abuse elsewhere. But even without the Pentagon directives and without memos that sanctioned interrogation, harsh interrogation, interrogators and soldiers engaged in abuse for a variety of reasons. They engaged in sleep deprivation, even without Rumsfeld's memo in Bagram. Abuse was also encouraged and tolerated, as I said, for disciplinary reasons. And abuse often occurred because officers simply looked the other way or discouraged reporting abuse. And systemic impunity is an important component. It's an ingredient that I think gets overlooked. Overlooking abuse, failing to investigate abuse and torture, and discouraging or ignoring whistleblowers really paved the way for abuse to continue and grow. As far as we know, no one in Battalion 168 was investigated or punished for detainee abuse. The other part of the book deals with, as I said, some of the unrecognized costs. And the experiences of abuse and torture, of course, very damaging for the detainees. Many of them were tortured in ways that didn't leave marks, and that inflicted its own kind of trauma. But it also damaged the troops in various ways. It's not anything that's particularly new, in a sense. For example, in 1983, Congress set up what was known as the National Vietnam Veterans Readjustment Study, which was a four-year study that included interviews with 3,000 veterans. And the researchers found that the exposure to or involvement in prisoner abuse, including other forms of abusive violence, had the highest correlative with PTSD. So There has not yet been as comprehensive a study for today's veterans in terms of the causality of PTSD and so forth. There just isn't yet one that is as sweeping and longitudinal and so forth. But in the case of the soldiers from Battalion 168, soldiers who engaged in abuse and torture were clearly traumatized. There was a very common set of patterns which involved serious substance abuse, fighting against anxiety and depression, violent outbursts, attempted suicide, and in the end, there were two soldiers who took their lives. And that is, unfortunately, one way in which the legacy of detainee abuse and torture is still playing out today.
Josh, could you tell us a bit about the stories of the two soldiers who did take their lives?
Well, in 2006, I was researching one of the dimensions of the story that I just described, the problems that troops faced with reporting abuse and torture. There was a number of problems with systemic impunity. Problems that whistleblowers faced just represented one of those problems. But there was a veteran from Iraq Veterans Against the War named Jonathan Milans who contacted me, and he described in very sort of opaque ways what he and his unit had done. And this older soldier was Jonathan Milans, and the unit was Battalion 168. And he wanted to contact me because he wanted to describe what the unit had done, the problems he faced with reporting the abuse, the problems that other members of his unit faced, but also what troubled him was not just that it was a failed effort, but he saw the imprint of that abuse take its toll on fellow veterans. One of his friends, not necessarily a close friend, but someone that he knew in the military, was so damaged from it, he had taken his life, and this was Sergeant Adam Gray. Jonathan Milans thought that that Sergeant Gray was that he committed suicide. It wasn't clear to me at that point if this was true. It wasn't clear to me what exactly he and his unit had been involved in. But that's what basically started me down this journey. And the first time that I met with Jonathan, 3 days after I interviewed him, he attempted suicide. And, we had this very long, complicated relationship where he would dip in and out of touch and relay a lot of painful experiences to me. And just when it seemed like he turned a corner, and around 2008 or 2009, he ended up also taking his life in 2009. And it was actually very surprising. I thought that he had been improving at the time, but he and Adam Gray both directly referenced their experiences with detainee abuse as being one of the main sources of their distress. It wasn't exclusive to it. There were other incidents that they were involved in, and one cannot say definitively, of course, that this was the thing that sent these two soldiers over the edge, but clearly it was a contributing factor.
Thanks, Josh. We're going to hear next from Michael Blake. Between 2003 and 2004, at the age of 20, Mike served in the U.S. Army at Camp Anaconda. That's about 5 miles from Fort Operating Base Lyon in Iraq. And Mike was discharged from the Army in 2005 with conscientious objector status. He then attended SUNY Cortland, earned a bachelor's degree in political science, and he's been active with Iraq Veterans Against the War, and he's currently the program manager for Veterans Sanctuary, a group in Ithaca, New York, a newly formed nonprofit that is committed to a model of peer support for returned Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans as they readjust to civilian society after discharge from the service. For those of you who have read Josh's book, Mike appears in the last chapter. Mike, you were a friend of Jonathan Milans. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, I can. First of all, I'd like to thank the Institute for having me here and to sit on this panel with such distinguished guests. And I'd like to thank Josh for having me here as well. And the fact that he did such an exhaustive study of my unit, I learned things about what we did there that I had no idea about before. I was a unit supply specialist in 168. I was a Humvee driver. I drove around logistics officer, and I was also a 5-ton driver. I brought supplies and mail back and forth from the big logistics base at Balad to FOB Lyon every day. And little did I know, at a small jail right near the gate, that was where all this torture was going on. I met Johnny at a training exercise when he was new to my unit in 2002 in the Mojave Desert, and we deployed to Iraq together in 2003 with the 4th Infantry Division. Once we got north, there wasn't all that much resistance, but a couple of months went by and there were more attacks, and I lost touch with Johnny because he got farmed out to one of the tank companies. He was a medic, and he was doing the war stuff day to day. I was mostly on the base going back and forth, but Johnny was really going out with the tank companies, and he was a guard in that jail. And in that jail, he helped hold people down while they dumped water in their mouths, and he held people in stress positions. Played loud music so that the detainees couldn't go to sleep. And we would go out on raids, and we would pick up every man from age of 14 to 60 and load them all into a truck and send them back to our base. And we would have those detainees for a couple of days before they got transferred to a bigger base. And during that time was when a lot of abuse happened, in that time in between, before they got to a major jail facility. Now, what I wanted to talk about mostly was Johnny, after he came home. I joined Iraq Veterans Against the War in 2005 after I left the service, and Johnny joined with me, and we spent about a year or so protesting, and I thought that was really motivating him because he was clearing his conscience about some of the things that he did, but he still didn't open up the darkest secrets. He didn't even tell me about what was happening in that jail. All he ever did was just show me one photograph of a detainee holding something heavy in the air, and they were forcing him to smile. I didn't understand what was happening there, but I watched Johnny come apart over the course of about 3 years. It started with the drinking, and he was drinking and driving and painkillers. And then he got into heroin, and I did everything I could as a friend to help him. I tried to get him a job, and I lent him money when he was down and out. And I just really reached my wit's end, and I realized there was nothing more I could do for him. And a year after we stopped talking, his mother called me to tell me he was dead. And I know that Johnny would be really glad that his story is being told in the book. And I know that the work that's done in that book is helping to put his spirit to rest, because he's bringing out those things that have to be told. And these things are uncomfortable to hear, but up until I talked to Josh, I had no idea that torture was going on in my unit. And my unit was no different than any other unit in Iraq. We held prisoners temporarily until they went to bigger facilities. It was happening all over the country.
Mike, are you able to shed some light for us on what might have triggered John to engage in torture and abuse of detainees?
I think it was probably peer pressure more than anything. I think at the beginning he really was just monitoring the prisoners' vital signs and making sure that they didn't die during interrogation. But I think after a while he felt pressure from the other guys in the platoon to help hold down detainees while they were waterboarding them, and to actually take part in the abuse that was going on. And, yeah, I think more than anything, it was just it was either peer pressure or, you know, hope for revenge. I mean, we did lose a man in our unit, and that might have something to do with it.
Our next speaker is Dr. Stephen Zanakis, who is a psychiatrist and a retired brigadier general with 28 years of active service in the U.S. Army as a medical corps officer. Dr. Zanakis has written widely on medical ethics, medicine in the military, and the treatment of detainees. And he has a commentary out with Len Rubenstein in the August 4, 2010 Journal of the American Medical Association called Roles of CIA Physicians in Enhanced Interrogation and Torture of Detainees. Dr. Zanakis has an active clinical and consulting practice, and he is serving right now as an expert witness for Omar Khadr, who is a Guantanamo detainee who will likely be the first Guantanamo detainee to be tried before a military commission following the amendment of the Military Commissions Act in 2009. Dr. Zanakis joined other retired generals under the auspices of Human Rights First several years ago to call for an end to U.S.-sponsored torture, and he has teamed up with Physicians for Human Rights to shed light on the role played by healthcare professionals in the torture of detainees. Steve, what can you tell us about the extent to which torture and abuse of detainees took place by American soldiers, and what can you tell us about the responses taken by the Department of Defense and the government to stop and reduce the incidence of torture and abuse?
Well, let me also add my thank you for the invitation to speak here, and also recognize Josh for the great job he's done with his book. It's a privilege, and thank you for inviting me. We don't really know how extensive this kind of activity that Michael is talking about really occurred. And I don't think we're ever going to know, except to say that, interestingly, one of the paradoxes that perhaps characterizes this war, that the commanding general of the 4th ID at that time was General Odierno, I believe. And he was chastised because these kinds of activities were common in his unit. But this man has, as you all know, is just coming out of Iraq and turned around and is one of the authors of the surge and the change in the strategy. So we've had a great shift in the mentality of particularly the uniformed leadership from the start of this campaign, this war in 02-03 to what we have now. Is the military going to systematically go about and ask themselves, how did this happen? How was it that, and I'm a career soldier, you know, it's complicated, or as a psychiatrist, I guess, you know, when the dinosaurs roamed Manhattan, I'd first start talking about my neurosis, but as complicated as it is to be an Army psychiatrist, I mean, I have loyalty to our military and to our country, and feel proud to have served despite all the difficult challenges that I faced throughout my career personally and professionally. But there's a place for the military, and there's a place for this military to go back and review how it got itself into the situation where it lacked the leadership, lacked the preparation, did not prepare the soldiers, did not put the right soldiers in the right jobs, and the kind of chaotic and inhuman actions that occurred did occur. Now, the interesting thing, the problem is that we did this once before. And after My Lai, we all came out of that and said, we're going to correct ourselves. We're going to become much more professional. And 20 years ago, when I was a student at the Army War College in Carlisle, we spent a good part of our studies looking and reading through how My Lai occurred and what its implications were for the Army at that time and the generation that followed. Somehow that got lost here, and I think that's the big question. Having said that, there's been a turnaround. in that we now see, and it has taken a while, that in fact, if you go out to the FOBs, the forward operating bases, you go into the combat theater, the number of incidents of this kind, I believe, have markedly diminished. And the leadership has come out both officially and unofficially and said these kinds of activities by our soldiers are unacceptable. It was very notably stated by General Petraeus in 2007 when he came in and to take over the operation in Iraq, and he published a letter after he had reviewed some data from a periodic mental health assessment there, and he said that we will not tolerate any kind of abusive treatment by our soldiers. It is clearly counterproductive. It is not the right thing to do. Does it still happen? Are there emotions? Are and the pitch of feeling is intense? Do people find themselves, particularly young people, either young soldiers on the front lines or young commanders and young sergeants? Absolutely, it happens. And that's the chaos of war. That's the ugliness of being in combat, and that's the fear and the apprehension and the sorrow to watch your fellow soldiers get killed and hurt that, in fact, can bring out the worst of any of us. Do we all know what's the best way to control it and handle it? I'm not sure that we have figured that out. I mean, that's part of the human condition that is such a challenge to us. Does it contribute to PTSD? I think it does, significantly. Do we know? Can we get that information from the soldiers? I think it's very hard. And as Josh probably documented, it's not very often that a soldier, in the course of seeing a counselor or even sometimes maybe doing the peer work that Michael's talking about, which I think's going to be most effective, are we really going to start to hear that these kinds of things bothered these young men and women.
I could ask you as a psychiatrist, what can you tell us about the individuals who, in the first place, engage in torture and abuse of detainees, and what are the conditions that are conducive to torture and abuse? And second, which of those individuals who engage in torture and abuse are most likely to suffer the debilitating symptoms and such as Jonathan Melance and Sergeant Gray?
Well, that's... I think I would like to make sure that we don't somehow err and think that there's a profile of a person who's going to do something like that. I mean, in the wrong situation, at the wrong time, any of us, you know, I mean, God forgive us what we might do. And so I think that it is most important to recognize that these kinds of things happen and that we're talking about young men and women, about post-adolescence, 20-year-old boys and girls who come into the Army for all sorts of different reasons, unformed in all sorts of different ways, looking to become somebody or do something, and placed in absolutely some of the harshest and most challenging circumstances that you can imagine. And we don't know, as they're, you know, all the neuroscience that we've got about how they're changing and how they're developing, what they're going to be like at 25, or what we're going to be like, you know, as we mature over the years and how we're going to change. So it's hard to tell what's going to happen to these young men and women. Having said that, therefore, the responsibility lies with the commanders. And it's all about what we talk about of command climate. It's as a commander at the company level, as a captain, or at the battalion level, or as a general officer, as a commander, it is the responsibility of the commander to set the rules, to know what's going on, to go out and reach and touch every individual in his or her command the best that we can. Now, it gets difficult when you're a general. And it's difficult sometimes as a colonel when you're commanding 4,000 people. but you have to set the command climate and set the rules, both spoken and unspoken, because the commander is responsible for what is done and not done. So now the other question was about
who is likely to fall into, who of those who engage in torture and abuse, which ones are likely to be susceptible to the problems?
Well, I mean, we've got other folks here that probably are as good or better than I to speak. But, I mean, you have to have young people who feel guilt, who are able over time to be able to think back on their experience and are bothered by it. I mean, I have seen, as others in this room have seen, those interrogators or soldiers who have absolutely to compartmentalize what they've done and have very little compassion about anyone that they're working with or someone that they've subjected to interrogations. Those people, I don't think, are going to be bothered. And I don't, in my experience, as I see them and talk to them, they're not bothered. But the young person who, as he or she grows from 22 to 30 to 32 and has a kid and has a marriage and then finds that perhaps the face they're looking to reminds them of a face that they might have hurt, and they feel that guilt, then those people are going to be vulnerable to having problems.
Steve, our next panelist is Susan Burke, an attorney and a partner at Burke PLLC. Susan is the lead counsel in three pending lawsuits that she co-counsels with the Center for Constitutional Rights, brought on behalf of more than 300 former detainees at Abu Ghraib, Camp Cropper, and other U.S. detention centers in Iraq who were subjected to torture and other human rights abuses. These detainees seek redress from two defense contractors, Khaki International and L3, and charge that employees of these two companies served as translators and interrogators and participated in torture and abuse. Susan also served as lead counsel in seven lawsuits that were brought against another defense contractor, Z, or formerly Blackwater, over numerous shooting incidents, including the September 16, 2007 Nisour Square shootings in Baghdad. These suits were settled last year, and compensation was obtained for families of 22 persons who were killed and 46 persons who were injured. In addition, Susan represents military personnel in a class action negligence suit that charges KBR and Halliburton with disposing of waste in open air burn pits that cause serious physical injuries, including cancer and permanent respiratory damage to soldiers and civilians. Susan, you stand out in Josh's book as one of the heroes for your truly brave, tireless, and persistent pursuit of justice for victims of torture and abuse at the hands of the U.S. military and military contractors. By early 2003, you were already out of the gate developing cutting-edge litigation strategies for imposing liability on military contractors. Now you work full-time on litigation against military contractor abuses. What made you decide to take on this work?
Well, I really think it was a sense of patriotism. I was just a regular trial lawyer, not doing, you know, much human rights work, a little bit on the side involving other countries, when I read a Washington Post article, December 26, 2002. And in it was written by Dana Priest, and in it she quoted a Bush administration official who said, well, if we're not violating human rights, we're not doing our job. And I was just appalled by that. And I'm a child of the military. My dad is career military. I have a lot of regard for the military. I grew up on military bases. And from my vantage point, that seemed just such an aberrational statement that required some kind of citizen uprising against it. But I assumed that other people would handle that part and was kind of sitting back to wait and see where the pushback would come from. But what in that at that era, there weren't enough people out there pushing back against it. I had found it so shocking that I just started working on it, and I started putting together, I mean, it's what I do, is I sue people and defend them. So I started thinking, well, you know, is my skill set able to be used in this arena? Can I try to turn around what our government is doing with lawsuits? And we began researching, you know, can we bring an injunction against the military, against the political leadership to enjoin the violation of the law? We did a lot of research. A lot of bright young law students at UPenn helped me, and we concluded, well, this is going to be a very difficult case. And so here we are, you know, 8 years later with still very difficult cases. We sued the defense contractors that basically give us an avenue that didn't exist in past wars. Here, there's been so much outsourcing that in every interrogation cell you had a translator. They became essentially often the fists that were doing the hitting. They're private employees, private companies. Many of the interrogators themselves, private employees from private companies. So we have our litigation, our strategy is to say, all right, this is clearly illegal. They're participating in illegal acts. It's a conspiracy, and we're going to sue you for participating in this conspiracy. So we've been at that, and we continue. We have an office in Baghdad, and we continue to get people walking in the door, recounting what has happened to them. And so we are waiting for a word from the Supreme Court whether they'll take one of our cases, and we've got a whole kind of second, third wave going as well.
Josh's book describes a remarkable trip that you took to Kuwait in June of 2005 to meet with staff of the U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Division. You brought to them many, many complaints and were received pretty much with a flat get lost. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I had this notion that the military, the Criminal Investigative Division, if they're doing their jobs, they are obliged to investigate these allegations. And so this is post the Taguba investigation, this is post the release of the information about Abu Ghraib. So there's no question at this time but that there's been very serious torture and abuse that's gone on. So we had been basically funneling in everything we were learning to the military, asking that it be investigated. And we kept pressing to meet, we kept pressing to talk to the people that were doing the investigating. We ended up, after a lot of struggling, deciding, okay, well, we're just going to have to fly to Kuwait to meet with them. So my investigator, Keith Roman, and I flew to Kuwait, and we met with two members of the detainee abuse task force. And we spent two full days in a hotel conference room, and it was one of the most depressing experiences of my adult life. Because by the end of it, the lead of the task force was telling me that he thought the Abu photos were faked. Neither of them had even read the Taguba report. We had brought with them information from our interviewing of the victims, including, you know, the bracelets that they had, the different documents that they had. We were trying to give them information about them, and their response back was, well, I rotate out in December. Maybe you want to bring it to the next guy. And then one was a man, one was a woman. The woman said something to the effect of, well, we actually don't investigate anything we think is preposterous. And so then I said, well, you know, gee, had you been brought a story of like a pyramid of naked men, would you have thought that was preposterous? Well, yes, and they wouldn't have investigated it. So I mean, it was very depressing. And we, at that point, essentially just gave up on the notion that there would be any investigatory help from the military. We continue to hold out hope. That hasn't really panned out. But we hoped that perhaps the Department of Justice would investigate. So we kept feeding our information into that task force. I finally, through my brother-in-law, who was at DOJ, I finally confirmed, you know, yes, our requests to meet with the head of that task force had gotten to him, but he had no interest. And this is the same fellow who then a week later said, well, gee, we'd really like to investigate, but we can't find any of the victims. I'm like, well, we got 300 on file in public records, you know, here in Virginia. I think you can find them if you want to. So the whole experience of expecting the investigation to come from the government has been very deflating. And to my mind, one of the things that I worry about is that we not give up. I mean, we still have got to investigate these crimes and develop a full record for this nation to truly move forward. So, you know, whether it's from private parties or whether we eventually can persuade DOJ and the military to do some investigating, I personally think for closure on the whole issue that we need to do that.
Susan, you also, when we spoke about this, mentioned that you were told that those who complained in detention were kept longer. And can you tell us?
Yes, that the dean, the fellow that was the head of the task force, he told me, well, you know, they don't want to send people out into the field to, they don't want to, go, if somebody has been released, it's, they don't want to go out into Baghdad to meet with them to learn what happened to them because it's dangerous. So therefore, they were detaining them. And I, at that point, said, you know, wait, let me get this straight. You're telling me that you have somebody who is ready to be released and that has been held, you know, separated from their families. They, you ask them, have you been mistreated in any way? When they answer yes, you then keep them in jail longer. That's exactly what they were doing. And needless to say, the prisoners quickly learned you answer no. And when they give you the paper to sign that says, have you ever been tortured? Have you ever been abused? You say no as quickly as you can because you want to get back to your family. So it's just one of the many practices that's appalling.
Right. Thanks, Susan. And our last speaker is Professor Darius Rajali, who's a professor and chair of political science at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, and one of the world's leading thinkers on the subject of government torture and interrogation. Professor Rajali served as an expert witness in the case of Abdul Rahim Aljenko, who was a Syrian Kurd who was mistaken for a terrorist by U.S. authorities, despite the fact that he was being tortured by the Taliban in Afghanistan. And he was held at Guantanamo Bay Detention Center for 7 years until a court ordered his release in June 2009. Darius's 2007 book, Torture and Democracy, offers in its 880 pages a sweeping and truly masterful account of the use of torture by democracies in the 20th century. His book won the Human Rights Book of the Year Award from the American Political Science Association and the Raphael Lemkin Award from the Institute of the Study of Genocide. In tribute to Darius, and it reflects his dedication to his students, a number of his students from Reed College are here, including our author, Josh Phillips. Darius, can you tell us what happens when soldiers who engage in torture and abuse of detainees come home?
Yeah. Let me take a quick point from Steve's point, which is that obviously reactions that torturers have to the conditions vary tremendously, and there's some people and PTSD symptoms that lead to suicide and so forth is part of the story, but there are many who don't. Let me explain one of the other ways in which torture comes home by telling you a story of it from a different point of view. I study in torture and democracy the study of torture techniques. I'm not really interested in people. I'm actually interested in how technology from torture transfers from person to person to person to person. So I'm actually interested in some sense, how torture subcultures develop and change over time. And I should also explain that I began doing torture and democracy in 1994, long before anyone was interested in this. And this comes out of my interest. My interest in torture goes back to the fact that I was a person born in Iran under the Shah, and I come from an old aristocratic family in which torture was not unknown in my family. So I grew up among torturers. So I have no problems from... I bring my own baggage to this issue. My first book was on the history of Iranian torture. Part of my motivation for doing the work I do is precisely to help the country that I now belong to not make the same mistakes that I grew up around. So one of the things that I've discovered, of course, is that when torturers come back from war, particularly if they've been MPs or soldiers, they have to get jobs. And one of the things I will draw your attention to is that there is a history, both in France and the United States, of soldiers who come back. And the most obvious choice, and you can see this in Josh's book at a couple places, is to consider doing police work, prison work, or private security work. And one of the interesting phenomena that happens then is that torture techniques that happen at the front show up in American inner cities and in other circumstances. And I'll give you a couple of very interesting examples. You all know the waterboarding, a slang for basically a family of three or four kinds of water tortures. There were water tortures in American prisons in the 19th century, but not what we would call waterboarding. Waterboarding was a very obscure technique that appeared primarily within Spanish colonies, and American forces were introduced and exposed to it in the course of the Philippine insurgency in 1904-1905. We know that, we also know that many of them came home, and we know from the 1931 study done by the American Bar Association that within a 20-year period, waterboarding, that particular technique, was common throughout the United States prison system, and in particular in the American South. So that's one example of a transference effect. And it continues. The last known case within the American system was in 1983, wherein a sheriff in Texas and two of his deputies were convicted for waterboarding their defendants to get confession, their prisoners to get confessions. Another example, which is much more recent and more directly in the news, is the conviction of Commander Burge. Commander Burge was the number two person in the city of Chicago in the police force. He was an MP in the Mekong at a base where there were interrogators, although he denies that he had any knowledge. The torture techniques that were used at that base, which are quite distinctive, suddenly appeared in South Side of Chicago in 1973 and in stories that subsequently piled up. Within a 20-year period, Commander Burge had brought in close to 50 detectives who had participated him in various coerced interrogations, which led ultimately Governor Ryan to suspend the death penalty in Illinois because they could no longer determine how many of the confessions that had been received in that process were true. Now, I'll give that a third example, which is not American, because I don't want this to be just the American story, and that is that some of you may not know this, but electrotorture by field telephone was, among other things, first introduced by the Americans in Haiti in 1919, but was most common in Vietnam in 1931 in the hands of French forces. It was a colonial technique. It passes on to Vichy, France in 1942 in Toulouse, that goes on to the Gestapo in Toulouse in 1943 and moves onwards. It's another example of how something just moves across time and space. One of the things I do, that's kind of what I do, which is I sit on the world's largest private torture archive for torture instruments, and I trace it, and that's what I do. And one of the things I think Josh's book draws our attention to is the blowback effect, but the blowback effect can take many different shapes.
Therese, I'd like to also ask you about some of the research you're conducting now on American public opinion on torture.
Sure. I'm working with my colleague Paul Gronke. We have our first major study out in PS Magazine in the Symposium on Terror and Torture. It just came out this summer. The first thing that we have been doing, and this is something that I've known for some time, is tracking every poll on American attitudes in ticking time bomb situations on torture. And one thing that I knew from collecting them was that everywhere I went, I thought most people thought that most American, when I would ask an audience where you think Americans stand on torture, most people would tell me that they thought 60 to 80% of Americans supported torture in ticking time bomb situations. In fact, the polling, and this is at this point now 34 polls in the Bush administration period, all consistently produced exactly the same numbers, which is that Americans oppose torture 65 to 35%, with a plus or minus variation of 4%. So the question was, what was causing a misperception in my audiences? What was going on? So we subsequently did a second study in 2008, in which we attached a question to the Congressional Election Survey, in which we asked, we did a very simple psychological experiment, which I do to my college students all the time. So imagine if you're college students and you say, how often do you smoke? 2 or 3 times a week. How often do you think your average Reed College student smoke? And theoretically, when you get the two numbers, you're going to get something. If they're very accurate, you'll get two numbers that are exactly the same. If there's a variation, there's difference. So for my Reed College students, you'll be interested to know that when we ask how often do you have sex and how often do you think your friends have sex, you think most of your friends are losers, but you're doing pretty well. But in fact, most of you are all actually doing pretty well. So it's a very simple psychological test. And we ran it, and we basically said, where do you stand on a ticking time bomb question? Where do you think the average American stands on the ticking time bomb question? And we got, not surprisingly, a gap. The perception was that there were more Americans who were for torture than there actually were. And then, even more interestingly, when we mapped it across the intensity of your feeling about the question, what we found was that the more pro-torture you were, the more mistaken you were about where the American public stood. And conversely, the more anti-torture you weren't. So for example, people who thought that sometimes torture was acceptable in a ticking time bomb situation, about 35% of our sample thought that 65% of all Americans agreed with them. Okay. The third point I'll make, and I'll hand this back to Nancy, is that starting with the election of, well, just before the election of President Obama, the numbers started shifting. And just as there had been a strong anti-torture majority throughout the Bush administration period, and by the way, that's comparable to other Anglo-Saxon countries. I wouldn't want you to think that the Scandinavians are up at 100%, right? The Scandinavians are about like between 75 and 80%. And in our country, historically going back, 27% of all Americans have usually favored a nuclear first strike on Russia. So kind of keep that in a perspective. But the other thing that we found is that starting with the election of President Obama, the numbers started shifting. And so now we have pro-torture, not quite majorities, but there's definitely a surge pro-torture as Obama has become president. And the anti-torture numbers have gone in the opposite direction. And the thing that counts for this seems to be a 20% shift among Republicans. Up until the president's, till 2008, we couldn't find any very strong partisan indications for torture. Democrats and Republicans were equally opposed and equally for torture, but post-Obama, equally important one.
Thank you to all of the speakers. At this point, I'd like to open up the floor to questions. We have a microphone in the middle of the room, and I'd appreciate it if you'd identify yourself.
My name is Steve Adler. I appreciate all the participants, but something is missing in the general conversation. In Vietnam, as I understand it, a million people or more were killed, and maybe a million more or so permanently maimed. Soldiers routinely engaged in cutting off people's ears for souvenirs. The overall climate promoted by the government and society of the United States and its allies was that it's okay to kill these people, not merely to torture them, but actually to kill them. To kill them on the ground or to kill them from 5 miles in the air. In Iraq and Afghanistan before that, the policy was it's okay to kill these people. And they were killed in Iraq by the hundreds of thousands. In Afghanistan, they continued to be killed. In the case of Afghanistan in particular, the human rights movement has almost totally failed. One can say almost anything terrible about the Taliban, and it will be believed almost without question by almost everybody.
May I ask you to get to your question?
Yes.
Thank you.
Do you feel that when reputable magazines such as Time, as they did just 5 weeks ago, publish statements saying that the Taliban executed women by cutting off their heads and kicked their heads around in stadiums, that it's the responsibility of the civil rights and human rights community to say that never happened?
Well, I would say that obviously that kind of sentiment contributes to a feeling of retribution, or that these things are permissible perhaps on some level, but that's why we have checks within the military, obviously, that you know, you're not, even though you're an enlisted soldier and you're engaged in combat, you have commanders that oversee you, as Steve articulated very well, and they're supposed to ensure that detainees are nonetheless protected, and Geneva serves a purpose for bilateral relations, of course. So I think it is something that may contribute to actually, one of the questions I try to ask in the book was, to what extent is this stuff a product of revenge? Or another question was, to what extent was torture done in response to violent attacks? And one of the things that I discovered was, you know, in Bagram in 2002, there's quite a bit of torture. We know from films like Taxi from the Dark Side and whatnot. But it turns out that there was actually a very steep decline of violent attacks on U.S. forces during the time in which the abuse and torture accelerated. So I don't think that those things necessarily correspond. And, of course, then you look at a place like Guantanamo, which is safe from attacks, a totally safe environment. The officers would joke that the only danger they faced was a car wreck, and yet they turned to abuse and torture. I don't know if that quite answers the question, but I hope I've addressed it in some way. Does anybody else want to take a crack?
My name is George Fallows. This is a question for Mr. Rehali. Do you think that the behavior of the U.S. Army was different during the Spanish War than it was in Afghanistan or Iraq?
interesting question. When I look back at the wars in which American troops have been involved, okay, when I've been looking at wars in which there are wars in which torture was common and wars in which torture was not. So, for example, although there are intermittent reports of torture by Allied troops during World War II, you don't find too much going on there, right? On the other hand, during the Philippine-American, during the Philippine insurgency and during the Vietnam War, what you find is a second kind of pattern, which is the torture goes from base to base, but primarily in the form of local middle-tier officers turning a blind eye to what's happening on the base, which is not an uncommon thing. So Lieutenant Calley, famously in Vietnam, could have been equally in the Philippine context. A lieutenant like Captain Edward Glenn, who was tried for torture in 1905, I think, or 1906. What makes the current war different is that, in addition to the fact that torture began from the bottom up, there was also legal documents authorizing stuff from the top down. And that was an entirely different phenomenon, and it creates a very different set of duplications. I guess I'd put another way, in a somewhat different context. When you study torture, and this is one of the ways that you have to think about this, you can't study every aspect of a war, right? So what I'm particularly interested in, what my answer is referring to in particular, are circumstances in which people are handcuffed and helpless, right? That's what I'm looking at. There are obviously, if you want to compare these wars in other contexts, for example, on the scale of battlefield atrocity, or, for example, on yet another area where another one of my students is working, which I think somebody mentioned, which is battlefield decapitation and taking body parts as souvenirs, you could actually produce a different, and I actually have students working on this too, right? I mean, let's face this, war is a deeply complicated phenomenon with multiple kinds of violence that are happening. And what I do is the particular area of torture. So I guess what I would say is that this particular war is different because of the documentary trail from the top. Whereas in the Philippine case and in the Vietnam case, what you find is the torture was primarily, there is no document trail from the top, but there is an enormous amount of tolerated behavior by middle-tier officers who allowed torture to spread from interrogation base to interrogation base. And that was also true in the Philippines.
Hi, my name is Sandra Schulberg, and my question is in response to what both Steve Xenakis and Susan Burke said. Kind of, you're coming from two different points of view. Dr. Xenakis, you said that you saw a change coming about within the military as there's greater consciousness and greater, perhaps, desire to address these issues of detainee abuse and torture. And yet we hear Susan Burke talking about the frustration of trying to get military officers who are supposedly responsible for these investigations, trying to get them to respond. And my question is, to what extent do you think that this reconsideration, if it's happening at all within the military, is coming about because of internal leadership, or to what extent do we think it might be affected by, let's say, books and films such as Taxi to the Dark Side or the film about Abu Ghraib? So I'm really asking, how do we, and I'm a movie producer myself, how do we expect to affect the culture within the military? What's the best way to have an effect, if it's possible?
I'm glad you asked the question. Because it gets, I'll try to answer it as best succinctly. It gets to the heart of a couple principles that anchor the military, which is that the military leadership answers to the political authority. And a shift in the political authority and what it, in its direction, and as well as the authority that it therefore gives to the senior officers, is very important, and they're highly influenced by the beliefs of the society. And I, just looking back at the 2008 campaign, when we as a group of retired generals interviewed any presidential candidate that would meet with us, this issue came up. It was what we wanted to talk to them about, and there was obviously the kind of reciprocation that showed that as military officers, we can influence the political thinking, but we as military officers are also subordinate to what our politicians do, and they're responsive to what they think the public is feeling and thinking. So it is very important for the sentiment to be clear, because that'll shape what we do within the military. Having said that, there are a couple other pieces. Which is, we bring in our recruits are young men and women. And the culture and the backgrounds they come from highly influence what we do as we go through our training preparation, and how we will therefore employ them in across the various duties that they're in. So the culture they come from and the attitudes that they have also influence what the Army, I'm speaking specifically about the Army. That's been constrained in moving to a full all-volunteer force from what we had as a draft army during Vietnam, but it's still one of the factors that plays there. Having said that, I want to get to your first point and then turn it over to Susan, which is it really incongruous what we said? And I don't think it is. If you can then, and maybe you can put this in a great movie, is see the veiled and intricate art of being a general officer and leader, and how you make decisions and not appear to make decisions, and how you avoid getting tarred by decisions that you don't want to be involved in, and then wait to get into a position of authority so that you can influence and change them. And it is no surprise to me that the senior leadership is going to systematically try and change the culture of the Army that was detrimentally affected at the start of this war, but will not do it in any open way, and will absolutely not allow any senior officer to be court-martialed or put on any kind of public trial.
Well, I think the question about whether the external, the movies and the external forces have an impact, you know, my own view is that we need to just work on all fronts, and that as with anything, you know, getting the military to change, getting the political establishment, I mean, it really needs united voices pressing. So, I mean, from my perspective, we've invited filmmakers and photographers. In fact, Chris Bartlett, one of the photographers that has come with us, is here in the audience. I think that, you know, anything that can be done should be done, because it goes back to what Darius was saying about public opinion. You know, it needs to be clear as a nation that we collectively don't endorse this, and that we'll seek to hold our leadership responsible for the mistakes that have been made.
My name is Scott Horton. I'd like to ask a question focusing a little bit more attention on accountability and integrity of the investigation process. And I want to give one of my own experiences at the outset. In 2006, I represented a CBS cameraman named Abdul Amir, who was seized by U.S. forces in Iraq for attempting to film an attack on a Stryker vehicle. Which was, by the way, his job, and he'd been sent to do it by the bureau chief of CBS News in Baghdad, but that evidence was unpersuasive in the view of the U.S. military. And he was held in Abu Ghraib prison altogether for more than 1 year. When I went there and spoke with Major General Gardner, who was in charge of the prison, he said that we treat every allegation of detainee abuse with the utmost seriousness. And I spoke with my client and learned that he had been repeatedly tortured while he was held there. He identified the people who had done the torture. He said that he had disclosed to them that he had a herniated disc, and they insisted on putting him in a specific stress position designed to accentuate excruciating pain from him as he was interrogated. The main focus of the interrogation sessions, by the way, trying to get him to agree to spy on CBS News for the Pentagon, which he steadfastly refused to do, amazingly. So we reported this abuse, and an investigation was undertaken, and I was told really within a matter of days that these were absolutely ridiculous accusations. There was no basis for them. And so when I next met with my client, I asked him, so when did they interview you? And he said, what? Interview? No, he was never approached by any investigators. He was never physically examined. And apparently the totality of the investigation concluded of putting questions to a couple of jailers who were uninvolved in the torture incidents. But with that was sufficient to close the file and conclude an investigation. And I think when we look at these numbers, you know, hundreds, thousands of incidents investigated, very few cases found to be of substance, you get this clear impression that there is a willful disregard of appropriate criminal investigative procedure throughout. And I think another great example comes in Steve Miles' book, Oath Betrayed, I think is the name of it, in which he talks about CID investigations, NCIS investigations, and says over and over again his examination of the files shows that there was no serious investigation. And he also says there seems to even be a measure of collusion in this avoiding proper investigation between medical personnel and the investigators. That is, there are cases where medical personnel are giving certificates or giving evidence which could not possibly be correct, all designed to shut the investigation down. So what do we do to get an NCIS that actually behaves the way they do on television? That's my question. Thank you.
I don't have an answer to your question, but I do know that that's certainly what we heard, that, you know, that notion that a case being closed, that it's been investigated and closed, when you talk to CID, that just means, for example, if they didn't want to go outside the wire to interview a victim, they'd close the case, and they'd chalk that up as an investigated and closed. None of the victims that we have interviewed have ever been interviewed by anyone, despite our sending the names, making them available. We've offered to bring them to the United States. No one has any interest in talking to the victims.
I'm really glad you brought this up, actually. It is addressed in the book to a certain extent. It's something that I'm continuing to work on. It represents a very big problem, for sure. Let's see. I would say one of the things that I've since discovered after writing the book was more about what's been going on with the what happened with the agents that were doing the investigations. And Susan does an excellent job of describing the various reasons why cases were closed or why they were inadequately investigated, both attitudinal and systemic and so forth. But I think that there were legitimate problems with the way the framework of the investigative process was set up. There were six agents in charge of hundreds of cases for one calendar year. They were absolutely overwhelmed. It's not to excuse the attitudes nor the the various reasons why they closed the cases, but I think it does shed some light on why so many cases were incomplete. Beyond that, beyond the simple detainee abuse task force and other efforts by CID or NCIS, there were a whole host of reasons why investigations floundered or why there was impunity. Yes, there were whistleblowers that were threatened. They were silenced. They were ignored. There were interrogators who filed reports about detainee abuse, and they went absolutely nowhere. And in fact, some interrogators went so far as to take notes on the charges that they filed, with descriptions of the personnel involved, and the CID says that they don't have any record of these investigations, which is kind of extraordinary. And of course, troops felt fear of retribution, and who wants to file an investigation if you feel that these investigations are taken seriously or if you're putting yourself in harm's way? So there's a whole host of reasons why there was systemic impunity. And in fact, Scott Horn is in the book as well, because he met with a soldier, Samuel Provence, who described an incident where a General George Fay, met with it was a large auditorium of soldiers getting back from Iraq who were in Germany. I can't remember where in Germany. Right. And he told the soldiers, if you did not report instances of detainee abuse and torture that you witnessed at the time that you witnessed them, then you are basically in violation. Yet another way in which soldiers were discouraged to come forward with complaints of abuse. So there's a litany of reasons why the detainee abuse and torture has not received enough accountability. There hasn't been thorough enough investigations. I think I'll leave it there.
Hi, I'm Dr. Alan Keller from NYU School of Medicine. I spent a lot of my career examining and caring for torture victims. First, my congratulations to just an incredibly eloquent and important panel. Thank you so much. Just two comments and then a question. As was alluded to by Steve and others, health professionals were front and center in perpetrating this abuse, in devising these methods, in training individuals in them, and even we did a recent report from Physicians for Human Rights in doing experiments on how to do these insane things better, if such a thing was possible, or at least providing some rationale for why they were doing it. And then the other point, as was made, is it's scary how easy it really is for this to happen. When I first started, I thought it was two-headed monsters that torture. But it's ordinary people, and it's in a context that allows it, that encourages it, and so easy to happen. My question's building on what Scott and others have asked about accountability. So we're, you know, halfway through an administration, or the first term of hopefully two terms. I'll set my bias there. has said, okay, you know, we're moving on. We're not going to do any further investigations, and we're committing we're not going to torture. My question is, one, what does accountability look like? Presuming you think it's important, and if you don't, I'd be interested to hear about that. So, one, what does it look like? And then, given the things that we've heard, given even a chilling poll, you know, as they say in medicine, above all, do no harm. You know, don't make things more likely that torture is going to happen. What is it going to take for us to get to accountability? How do we shift on that?
Shall I?
Sure.
So, Dr. Keller, five techniques. There are only five ways that we have historically looked at the issue of dealing with past human rights violations, whether it's xenophobia. Trials, apologies, truth commissions, purges. Yeah, the Soviets had that strategy. Come on, I mean, it's a strategy. There are only four. Those are the four strategies human beings have in the last century been able to develop to deal with the issue of accountability. Okay. In the human rights community, there's a huge debate about which of these is more effective in reducing violence in the long run or not. Myself, I throw my hat on the trial side. I like trials, and I'll tell you why I like trials, because there's actually a huge large-end study that actually shows that for military coups, that countries where people who try military coups and fail and are tried, the chances that someone will try a coup in the next 6 years falls dramatically. Basically, officers who got away with it the first time kind of think, you know, it didn't work out for those guys. I'm not going to get along with it. But it has to happen within 6 years. Otherwise, the effect is lost. Okay? So we got a window, if you want, right? So that's where I put my money on this, all right? But I obviously have friends who prefer truth commissions. I have a very dear friend in Australia who thinks that apologies done correctly can be transformative for a nation, as in the case of Aboriginals. You know, there are a variety of different possible strategies that you can take on this. But let me then move out of my wonderful friends with whom I have flowers and bunnies and all sorts of things with to my hard-nosed social science friends who love computers and statistics. Okay, and what they tell me is this, that basically effective accountability can only happen when three preconditions are present. Economic prosperity, lack of a perceived national security threat, and sympathetic public opinion towards human rights conditions. Which means, considering our circumstances, that if you thought accountability was going to happen sometime in this period, this is the wrong time. And I'll give you an example from the country in which I was born, just so you understand, because I've done this in a different way, too. The torture techniques that the Shah used in the 1970s were picked up and used immediately within a year in the Islamic prisons immediately afterwards. There was a continuity in torture techniques, even though all the torturers were gone at the top, the guys who ordered it. But, you know, every torturer needs a job, and guess what? There was another job available, right? And so people just passed on from one thing to another. Lenin discovered this was a pretty good technique, too. You just hire the Tsar's torturers and bring them over. So the problem is that in Iran, torture techniques changed in 1994, right? After the Iran-Iraq war was over, after there was some degree of economic stability, and just before reform began. All right. So, and if you look at the history of Iran, the history of torture techniques and changing and shifting, maps onto basically exactly the same statistical things that my friends identify. There is another study that just came out in the American Political Science Review called What Stops Torture, and it, again, reproduces the same effect. So I hate to tell you this, but yeah, we could, each of these things that we can do right now, they might have a modest effect in certain areas, in certain countries. In particular, I feel that professional associations, let's leave the government and trials out of it, I think every professional association needs to be able to deal with these issues. So the American Bar Association needs to deal with its lawyers. The doctors need to lead with their doctors, the psychologists with their psychologists. After all, torture is dangerous for professions, very particular ones. And they need to establish their own standards. And if we're going to stand around and wait for the state and citizens to do that, you might be waiting for a very long time.
Hi. I'm Daphne Evyatar. I'm with Human Rights First. And this is a great panel. And Josh, it's a wonderful book. And I really commend you for putting it together. I know how hard it was to do this investigation. I wanted to ask, just following up on some of the important questions that have been asked already, and this lack of accountability. At Human Rights First, we put out a report called Commands Responsibility several years ago. And I'm in the process of trying to update it now and look at the investigations of what happened to people who were tortured, and particularly who were killed by torture. At the hands of U.S. forces. And what we found is there's actually just less and less information available as time goes on. And under the Obama administration, and this is something that Stephen Miles has pointed out as well, they've stopped reporting deaths in custody. So my question is, if there is, and as we're all aware, the political situation right now does not really favor a big move towards accountability. But Dr. Xenakis, and you've done excellent work with Human Rights First as well, you seem to have a faith that the military is somehow kind of quietly reforming itself from within. And what I'm wondering is, how can we have that faith? I mean, as lawyers and legal groups and human rights groups, we always want to see, you know, a trial, a commission, something that brings us all out in the open. And I'm wondering, from the military perspective and also from the psychological perspective, can you have reform if you don't have accountability? If the people within the military never see the commanders held responsible, people who gave those instructions held responsible, can you really have a meaningful reform?
Well, I forgot to take my medicine this morning, so and I have to be totally try to be as honest as I can. I almost have to have faith. I mean, I've spent my life in uniform, and it would be a change of conscience and struggle with what might be the personal consequences. I mean, I have to have faith, and I have to believe that, in a way, and I'm saying this so that perhaps it would explain what my thinking is, that this institution that has endured, and this democracy that, as an army, is in this country, for all its faults, is a great country and has, I think, probably the best military that you could find on the globe. Has all the faults that we've identified here. How does it preserve itself and come out of what I think is a low point, and I believe has made, particularly in those early years, made some very serious mistakes. And I believe the medics were complicit, which, you know, I've spoke out early about that, and clearly was chastised by my friends and peers who were either still in the Army or had recently retired. And my dilemma is, in answering the question and sort of going back to Scott's point, who I have the highest respect for, and maybe I can entreat him to write another article, is the investigative process has been corrupted as well. I mean, and it's not just in when it comes to understanding what's happened to these poor souls. I mean, you can go through the what we call the warrior transition units, the WTUs, where many of our soldiers who've been injured are really kind of being kept for a while as they're going through disability ratings, and they're having all sorts of problems. And they're being, in my personal opinion, medical practice, are being overly medicated. And we've had 1,000 suicides. We've only had, but as compared to Vietnam, only 4,000 combat deaths. So we've had a quarter as many suicides as we've had combat deaths. Something's wrong. But this institution is, and I'm saying my military, my army, is extremely adept at doing exactly what you just said. If it's got a problem, it'll handle it in its own house. Now, it'll listen to whatever pressure is going to come out, and it'll be influenced, but will not be in an open form. So I believe that, except for making it public, truth commissions, I do not believe there will be the senior leaders held accountable who really should be held accountable. I believe that is a fruitless exercise. It's my own personal opinion. The truth commissions, the media events, and the public debate, that will, in fact, raise consciousness and perhaps influence the political leadership. But the directive action that I think we all think will happen, I do not think that in this economic climate, in an army that is going to have to downsize and is going to, in fact, be even more protective of its domain, I don't think we're going to see anything. That's my happy note.
I'd just like to add something real quick to that from an enlisted man's perspective, is that wherever there's combat and the U.S. is involved, I think there's going to be torture. Because at the unit level, at the smallest level, when detainees are rounded up, there's absolutely no accountability besides the sergeant. And if the people that you're rounding up happen to be implicated in the death of some of the guys on your team, there's going to be retribution. So wherever there's combat, I think there's going to be torture, regardless of any level of accountability.
Yeah, I'm an officer in the military. In 2009, I was in Afghanistan, intel officer. Oh, I'm sorry.
I hear you.
Yeah, hi, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, good. I'm an officer in the Army, intel officer. I was in Afghanistan for 2009. I served as a police mentor and also a mentor for an Afghan colonel who set up a coordination center in Nuristan province for the elections. And towards the end of my tour, I worked as a targeting officer for a landowning element in eastern Nangarhar. As far as the human rights question of like what we did to address the problems of torture, one is we really don't take prisoners anymore. That's kind of a modern misnomer. Early on in Iraq, what are you, specialist, private?
Enlisted? Yeah.
Roger. Early on in Iraq, the issues of torture were because they were rounding up large groups of MAMs, military-age males, bringing them in, holding them, and then pushing these large centers. And you have leadership fails. NCOs and officers do not do their fucking job. You're taught early on to treat prisoners according to the rules of war. It's not, you have rules of engagement, you have rules of war. The moment you engage in torture, you're basically a war criminal. So I'm sorry that happened, and I'm sure it's not the only time it happened, but yes, for that period from, say, the first month after Saddam's regime fell to, say, 2004 or 2005, there were many instances of torture because the military really did not have a clear mission. And when you have all these young males in the military, lack of leadership, lack of accountability, these bad things happen. General Petraeus kind of developed the COIN manual. COIN is counterinsurgency. Basically, how do you win or stabilize places like Iraq? And COIN stresses winning over the mass base, the people. You do this through engaging with tribal leadership, imams, and political leadership to create a stable environment. You combine that with reconstruction and building up and training and mentoring the police and the army element. So from my point, in Kabul, I mentored an Afghan police chief. We were trying to set up, and enforce the Afghan Jairoa rule of law. In that instance, I do not take prisoners. The Afghan police may, if they say like someone's harassing a business owner, like extortion, they roll up. If they decide they're going to arrest him, they arrest him. They follow through with their rule of law. I'm there just to supervise, make sure they're not terrorizing the people or taking bribes or corruption. In Nuristan, my main job was trying to secure safe and civil elections. Nuristan is very tribal. They don't really get along with a lot of the other Pashtun tribes. The Nuristanis have their own different ethnic group. So my main job was trying to get the sub-governors appointed by Karzai, the election rep appointed by Karzai, as well as the tribal leaders, to agree on a ballot movement, Afghan police presence at the actual polling site, and ballot movement back, so for full accountability without the appearance of corruption, which is very hard because the Afghan government is extremely corrupt.
I need you to get to your question.
No, I'm just making a point that, you know, as far as like systemic solutions, sir, you're correct. There's been many solutions, and certain individuals like General Miller with Tiger Brigade, who probably should be tried as a war criminal, that probably won't happen because the military, we do protect our own on some level. And we don't want one person to go down and drag the whole institution down with it. But we have made systemic changes in our policy. We realize we have past failures. That's all.
Can I just, well, there's one thing I would add. At the end, well, you can, I mean, it occurred to me since we're talking about solutions. You should know that the French, after Algeria, when they had their major torture crisis, it nearly came to a head in 1963, and General de Gaulle had it with the French military. Their French solution is really the fifth solution, and call that the nuclear option, if you will. But they disbanded the entire French military, the entire French colonial brigade. Every brigade was disbanded, and they rebuilt the French army from scratch. And you need to understand that de Gaulle, who was a general, was aware that once you have a deeply embedded torture culture at the heart of your military, which leads to a near coup in 1962, you have a serious problem in your democracy. So de Gaulle basically rebuilt the French military into what is now the new French military. I just want you to be clear that there is the nuclear option as well.
When they withdrew from NATO?
Yeah, that's exactly it. He completely redid it. But your conversation made me think about that there are options outside of the box too.
Thank you very much for your statement, your comment. I would say, you know, I definitely appreciate that point of view. Throughout the time that I was interviewing soldiers and intel officers and whatnot, I asked them, you know, what memo, directive, whatever, had the greatest impact on your perception of detainee treatment and interrogations. And without question, without fail, all of them said it was really relegation of detainees, not as POWs, but as detainees who didn't enjoy the same rights as prisoners of war, that had the greatest impact. And I would say, you know, there's that's symptomatic of the confusion that occurred. So even though people were, yes, as you say, violating the law of war, there was confusion that led to that environment of permissibility for a certain period of time. And I would also say, in the course of reporting on this, that without question, most seasoned intelligence officers knew not just that torture problematic that torture was a violation of human rights, but they realized that there were a whole host of practical problems that were associated with getting involved in harsh interrogation or torture for the purposes of an interrogation, and they realized that there were enormous blowback effects that really savaged intelligence operations.
I just want to add that this whole discussion just reminds me of the importance of the political control over the military, because it shouldn't matter whether the military wants to protect its own or not. It's the job of our nation, and it's the job of the law enforcement officials at the Department of Justice and elsewhere to prosecute war criminals. These people are criminal, and they need to be prosecuted the same way they would be in civilian life. And so I think that there needs to continue to be pressure on those arms of the government to step up and do their jobs. And, you know, certainly from my perspective, I'm going to keep suing people till we get somebody in a witness stand in some court somewhere. So.
Okay, I think we have time for only either one or two questions, depending on how quickly this goes.
Okay, I'll try to be concise. So it sounds like the Bush-Rumsfeld-Cheney version of command at the top is different from, we hope, from the Obama version. And yet, if the people at the top who have been in the military, who are still in the military, aren't going to be held personally accountable for cultural reasons, are there changes taking place at West Point or in basic training along the way to try and teach people the ethics that I mean, I think most of us have been, most people in this room, I'm sure, would say, if you put me there, I'm not going to do that stuff. And I'm sure there are people in the book who didn't do that. And one of the most amazing things was the story you told of, I think it was Major Scharf, the Nazi.
Hans Scharf. He was actually not a Nazi. He was with the German Air Force, but yes, he fought in World War II.
But the model of ethical interrogation was a German officer, which was just so mind-blowing to me.
And he gave a lecture at the U.S. Air Force.
Yeah, the Air Force brought him in to teach Americans how to be ethical. And so I'm just wondering, what kind of changes are taking place at the ground level within the military to help cultivate a different kind of soldier, and not so much a warrior, but someone who can have empathy and be compassionate?
The major, speak.
I'm getting ready. We're probably going to be deploying again. I'm with the New York Army National Guard, the 169th Infantry, down in Midtown Manhattan. We're probably going to be starting deploying again in 2012 to Afghanistan for another year. When you go through the pre-deployment mobilization training, you get a lot of cultural awareness training, not only just ethics, morality, but understanding and respecting Islamic culture. And that's how you win in Afghanistan, by winning the people over to your side. But, you know, studying Pashtunwali, Pashtun culture, finding out how not to offend someone, how to work with them, how to win them over, how that, you know, NCO's leadership, once you take somebody in, if you have to arrest somebody, you get over to the Afghans as soon as possible. You do not want any prisoner with you for any long period of time, because bad things can happen. So the idea is you take that individual, arrest them, hand them over to the Afghan authorities. And secondly, whenever you go anywhere, unless you're like special forces conducting a raid of some kind, you're always going to have an Afghan presence with you. You're always going to have Afghan police or army with you. So basically, through the training they give you interacting and working with the Afghan police and army, it goes a long way to taking away a lot of that gray area, which Mr. Phillips has talked about in his book, as far as that, you know, not really knowing the mission, not knowing your rules of engagement, not knowing the status of the actual detainee, and trying to turn it more into an exercise in nation building. It's all Afghanistan and Iraq really are. We're trying to build the Afghan army and police up to the point where we can't be there anymore. Like Iraq, for the most part, is pretty much built up. My buddy just left with Third ID, and once in a while, like once a month, they went on a patrol with the Iraqi army and never got hit, nothing ever really happened. It's still a violent place, but it's all internal struggle. It's not really our conflict at this point in time. But Afghanistan, stability, stabilizing Jairoa. Jairoa is a government of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, and we're trying to basically build up the army to the point where they can protect their own borders, and a police force that can actually enforce the rule of law as per Kabul.
My question, go
ahead. Negative. Afghanistan has been stabled in, well, probably the history of Afghanistan.
As far as the training goes, though, that may be pre-deployment training that he's talking about, but basic training, the drill sergeants are still teaching the recruits pain through stress positions. And those are the basic torture techniques that soldiers in my unit used to torture Iraqi detainees. So the same thing that was being taught in basic training. I'm not talking about anything complicated. I'm talking about just holding your arms over your head with your rifle until your arms fall off, basically. It's not complicated, but it's still being taught in basic training, and I don't think that'll change.
Nor should it. That builds good soldiers.
I mean, thanks. We're on the panel there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we have time for exactly one more question. Denny, are you still here?
It's a little different. It's for Professor Rajali, and thanks very much for your book and for yours. But you talk about tracing techniques to moving from Iraq and Afghanistan into corrections, security guards, and American police forces. What about the other direction? How much was there a significant amount of... I know Grainer was a corrections officer.
Yeah, well, I mean, let me just say that the examples I used were examples from, you know, 30 to 80 years ago, right? And in fact, one of the things that I'm working on now for a book that will probably come out in 4 years is exactly this, is to look at techniques primarily in Iraq. I'm doing a pattern tracing exactly on the same model. So I won't have a real good answer for you right now. What I can tell you is that, yeah, techniques actually go in both directions. So let me give you an example. Yes, you know about Grainer, but you also may or may not know about the Crone Detention Center in Miami and the kinds of techniques that were used at the Crone Detention Center for the INS lockups in the 1990s turned out to be incredibly similar to what you see at Abu Ghraib. The point is that, this is what I always tell my students, which is torture doesn't read the United Nations rules on where the boundaries are. It travels in all sorts of really interesting ways. Sometimes it travels by imitation, and sometimes it travels by transference as a soldier comes back. Sometimes it travels through educational programs to build up tough soldiers. It can travel in any number of directions, and that's why it's really hard to trace. Obviously it can go from domestic to the war front. A particularly interesting example, if you want, is this one. In 1880, the British were trying to decide to eliminate whipping their soldiers because they thought that might actually lead to huge public problems. And so they decided that they would go to what they called field punishment number one, which involved standing on a box with your arms extended, a position known as crucifixion by the soldiers who were subjected to it during World War I. It then appears in in Ireland in the prisons in the 1900s. It appears in a variety of different places. Big surprise, it appears in a lot of former British colonies, South Africa, and then the great innovation of the Brazilians, which was to add electrical wires to the ends of your fingers and add a hood. And in Brazil in 1972, this was called the Vietnam. So let me, and it never appears in Vietnam, but it's a technique that has, that technique does not appear. In Vietnam, our soldiers copied the Vietnamese who had learned their techniques from the French, and their techniques are French. There are you have to understand there are two styles of torture, Anglo-Saxon modern and French modern, and they're just different. They're just very different styles. And there's Soviet style and a couple other styles that are sort of somewhat more modest. But, you have to have a sense of humor about what I do, right? it's the only way you can, you get it. The point is that techniques don't respect these lines. And I'll give you another one. Standing on blocks of ice, subjecting yourself to hypothermia, was a technique that appears in the Korean War, but suddenly appears in Venezuela in 1954, called the 38th parallel. I just want you to understand that if you actually do a global mapping of torture, what you realize is that the connections and the backroom ways in which torture travels is really interesting, because unlike, say, nuclear weapons or other sorts of things, there's no Jane's Torture Weekly where you can kind of flip through and see the latest medical techniques and use them. So we're talking about incredibly sophisticated and complicated backdoor networks, torture subcultures. And to me, the greatest problem is not so much accountability in the sense of the higher-ups, obviously, but the challenge of the 21st century will be to find methods to think about how do you deal with torture subcultures, how do you get them to disaggregate, what are the kinds or forms of incentives, maybe accountability is part of it, that will make torture subcultures disaggregate, whether they're domestic or international.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being an amazing audience. I want to thank all of our speakers, and I want to thank Josh for an outstanding book that I commend to all of you. Thanks. Thank you.